We'll call this meeting of the Energy Committee to order. Welcome, everyone. So first item on the agenda is to approve the minutes from February 19th meeting. Anyone, Representative Kraft, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Chair Ekam, and I move their approval.
Great. Any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The ayes have it and the minutes are approved. So today we have the great opportunity to get a briefing from the Minnesota Climate Innovation Finance Authority. We want to welcome you all to committee. We have Kari Groth Swan and then I think Eric Horrett, I believe, as the Chief Financial Officer. So welcome to committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourselves and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you so much, Chair Ekam and Chair Swazinski and all of the other representatives welcoming me here today. For the record, I am Kari Groth Swan. I am the Executive Director of the Minnesota Climate Innovation Finance Authority. As Chair Ekam said, with me is Eric Horrett. He is our Chief Financial Officer. He brings state government experience both from Minnesota and where he served in Louisiana, also as Undersecretary. Over here is my staff attorney, Peter Jones. He brings about 15 years private sector experience and 10 years as an attorney on tribal lands. I will be the one leading the hearing today. Eric may answer questions as needed. A little bit about me before we get started. I have a very deep background in banking, finance, wealth management, and economic development. I am new to state government. It is my true honor to be leading as the first permanent executive director of MNCFA. And it is a little daunting to stand up a new, truly financial institution that is also a state agency. What I'm going to do today is tell you a little bit about MNCFA, explain what that acronym is, talk about our operations and our budget, talk about what we finance and how we monitor what we finance, and a little bit about our plans for 2026. So let's start with what does MNCFA do? We are here and we were created to protect our climate and our way of life now and for future generations. Minnesota is transitioning to a clean energy future, and MNCFA is really here to help with that acceleration. This is a future that is going to be more affordable and cleaner, more reliable and safer. Innovation. We have had public, private, and nonprofit organizations access our capital for loans. We have placed a priority on communities that have been historically underserved. And we know, for example, that rural areas face far more challenges with access to capital than the urban center. We also have placed a priority on leveraging federal tax credits. This includes the solar and wind ITC tax credits that will sunset in July of this year. And we have brought in more than our fair share of federal dollars to Minnesota in our short time of existence. Authority, finance authority. Unlike most state agencies, we provide loans and not grants. Our lending is having a direct impact, accelerating projects, and we are drawing in a lot of private capital investment. We have several statutory requirements. All of our loans must be $250,000 or greater, and all of the loans must demonstrate the benefits to the community. Does it save energy? Does it reduce costs? Other states have other green financing authorities, and I am proud to participate in both of the national coalitions. It has helped me learn all about the best practices across the country, and it has also helped scale us in ways that we could not have done had there not been an ecosystem. There are only 8 states without a green financing authority. We are also learning from other state agencies. We are what is known as a body politic, and so we are learning from Minnesota Housing and also the IRRB. Let me explain a little bit more about our statute and our operating structure. As you all know, thank you, we were created in 2023. My title is an executive director. I am not a commissioner. I am not a political appointee. I report to a board of directors of 13 members whom were appointed by the governor. About half of those represent other state agencies who serve with me on the climate committee for climate action, for the climate action framework. So housing, deed, commerce, labor. The other third represents financial experts, renewable energy experts, and people representing outstate Minnesota and environmental justice communities. All of our board meetings are open to the public and held in a hybrid situation. And all of our minutes, all of our projects that we have funded, all of that is publicly available on our website. We are operating with $105 million in state funding, and thanks to the state, this has proven to be our most reliable source of funding. We received a one-time appropriation of $45 million, and then we also received a $60 million transfer from Commerce for the State Competitiveness Fund. We are set up as a revolving loan fund to be self-sustaining. We loan out money, we get it back, we loan it out again, and you will hear more about the types of projects we have loaned money out to. But we are catalytic. We are really putting money into the marketplace, earning a revenue and a rate of return on it, getting paid back, and loaning it out again. We have had several funding implications at the federal level, not probably surprising to anyone here who has followed the national trends. We received a $25 million grant from the Coalition for Green Capital. This was funding that Congress had appropriated. It has now been frozen for over a year, and it is in ongoing litigation in the District Court of D.C. We also were pending a $24 million grant on the Solar for All program. That is also pending and in litigation. Perhaps one of the most significant federal impacts to the Green Bank, Minnesota Climate Innovation Finance Authority, was when the Loan Program Office at the Department of Energy stopped considering renewable energy projects. They were going to be a big source of bringing federal money to projects here in Minnesota. And lastly, I think you all know that the ITC solar and wind tax credits will sunset. The good news is there are still tax credits available for storage, geothermal, and advanced manufacturing. But all of this federal impact is having a direct impact on projects here in the state of Minnesota. So to that end, by statute, we are actively trying to crowd in, and we are demonstrating how we have crowded in other private and public dollars to support the loans that we are putting into place. A little bit about our operations and budget. To date, or before our FY26, our budget is $3.3 million, and our revenue, cash revenue, is $3.6 million. But because we also accrue interest, our true revenue is close to $5.5 million. And we prefer and we look at the accrual basis because that is a much better sense of what our financial health and our long-term profitability is going to be. To date, we have closed on $23.1 million in loans. That money is out the door, and it has funded projects where we have had ribbon cuttings. We have also approved 14.3 additional million in loans. Those loans have been approved by the board of directors, and we are now in the process of negotiating the close of those loans. Once those loans are closed, the money will go out the door. We have about 100 million currently in our active pipeline, and we are issuing, or we have issued 2 weeks ago, a call for applications for another 50 million. It is our goal this year to deploy 50 million in new loans to projects statewide. As you can tell, we've already loaned out $43 million in our first 2 years of existence. That was with a very skeletal staff. Now that I have a robust staff, we're confident that we can get those projects completed and out the door. I just want to make a punctuating point that because we do loans, you know, we are constantly going to be able to be catalytic and, you know, getting the money back out the door once the loans are repaid. We have a very robust, systemic, and analytical process from the top of the pipeline to getting a loan closed and monitored. I like to think of us as a community bank with a mission. And I came from a banking background, and so a lot of the processes and procedures that we have set up have truly mimicked what happens in your local community bank. We first start with the staff. Anyone who wants to submit a project will engage with my investment team. They will conduct due diligence and determine what type of collateral and what type of terms and conditions are needed on the loan. It then goes to the credit committee. The credit committee is made up of a subset of the board of directors. At this meeting, we really dig into the financials, the audited financials, the backgrounds on the developers, the budget of the process, who else is in the capital stack, and background checks on the developers. If the credit committee, and that committee is a closed session because we are really talking about personal financial information and proprietary technology. If the credit committee feels that this loan should get funding, it is then voted and goes to a full board meeting, which I said earlier is held in public. The loans are then re-articulated in a more a simple way without some of the financial data because we're in a public setting, and then it goes to a full roll call vote. And thus far, every loan that we have brought to the board has approved. But I do want to note that we have turned down loans both at the staff level and at the credit committee level, which is the process, right? We don't want to take somebody to a public meeting and then say no. After the board has approved it, it goes back to the staff. We negotiate the close of those loans. The money is then dispersed. So all of that process happens on what I call the front of the house, the investment team. After the money goes out the door, it goes to the finance team, who does all of the loan monitoring, all of the invoices of the payments, all of the ongoing risk analysis that's done on a quarterly and an annual basis. This is really the key to our success, is this rigorous, arduous process that we are doing. As I said, we have $23.1 million in closed loans. The loans are typically 2 to 7 years. The average loan amount is about $2 million. We've given away as little as $500,000 and as much as $5 million. And 90% of our projects have gone to communities that are historically underserved by the capital markets. Of this $23.1 million that we have loaned out, there has been another $107 million that we have crowded into these projects. We only provide a very small portion of the project costs. So our leverage currently is about 5 to 1 on the dollars that we're lending out. Of the $14.3 million that is approved and we are negotiating, that $14.3 is actually crowding in close to $171 million. And that is because some of those are advanced manufacturing sites and bigger projects. So the overall budget is a larger amount. So I think that we are a pretty good bang for the state buck and a pretty good bang for the taxpayers. Additionally, almost all of the projects have taken advantage of the investment tax credits, and that will pay them back somewhere between 30 to 40%, depending upon the project and where it is situated. I'm going to just tell you a little bit about some of the projects, because this is where I think the excitement comes and where you can really see the projects come to life. Qualified projects are what we call loans. And again, just to reiterate, we have funded both public and nonprofit and private projects. We have done this all across Minnesota. We have leveraged various financing tools, and we are agnostic in the technology that we underwrite. So we have done solar, we have done storage, we have done geothermal, we have done HVAC. We are agnostic to the technology. The first project that I'd like to tell you about is 10-site solar portfolio. It was with one developer named Lake Street Solar. They put together 10 projects, 10 nonprofit community faith-based organizations. They were the one developer that was going to work on 10 sites. The panels they installed, you can see me here, on top of the Celtic Junction Center. It's an art center in St. Paul with both the developer and the leaders of the Celtic Center. These solar panels on all of these community organizations are significantly reducing the energy costs that these buildings have, and that allows for more dollars to go into the community programs that they are running. And again, this was a very exciting project for us. And it was the first time I'd ever been up on the roof with solar panels in my job, so it was pretty fun. Next one. Another project that we are very excited about is the Sandstone School Workforce Housing. This is such a beautiful building. If you've ever been to Sandstone, it's known as The Rock. It's over 100 years old. It stood vacant for about 20 years. And there were bats and squirrels. It was vacant. And there was a developer from Duluth who had the insight to pair state historical tax credits with our investment ITC tax credits and turned this building, this old schoolhouse, which was, you know, drafty and cold, into 32 units of workforce housing. It's also going to house a museum for that area. This is really critical for the economic vitality of Sandstone. There are two large employers that live in that area, a large casino and a large hospital center, that did not have affordable workforce housing. They had people commuting over an hour and a half each way to work in this area because there wasn't housing in Sandstone. So these units are very critical for the viability of the Sandstone community. Next slide. And lastly, this really goes to kind of the innovation in our name. Carba Inc. Is a reactor that was founded by a University of Minnesota graduate. It actually takes like old trees and branches and woody mass and converts it into stable biocarbon. And this is a wonderful project for landfills in any county across Minnesota because they're all facing the same challenges. This is really growing our clean energy economy. Microsoft is taking the carbon offtake from this project. The project created crowded in both philanthropic and private investment, and our $500,000 loan allowed them to turn around and get another $6 million from private capital. We funded one reactor on the site. They are going to build two more on the site. So it's just a really exciting project for us, and it shows how far $500,000 in a loan can go for new innovative technology. Lastly, we are preparing right now for 2026 and beyond. As I mentioned, we issued a $50 million call for applications. That is live. You can see it on our website. All of the criteria that are there around the lending standards, the type of projects we're looking for, what the deadlines are. We have a very significant outreach and engagement plan that covers the entire state to let people know that we are here and ready to deploy money. We are doing webinars, and we are targeting specific cities to get this word out. And certainly, all of you, I'm hoping, can go back to your constituencies and let them know that, you know, MNCIFA is open for business and ready to finance some other great projects. And that kind of concludes my formal presentation, and I will take questions.
Well, I thank you very much for that. It's certainly exciting to see this come from the bill that was drafted and passed several years ago to all of this tangible outcome. So thank you for sharing that. We do have a few people who are interested in some questions. First up is Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate it. And thank you for your presentation. A couple questions about your loan terms. Sounds like they're between 2 and 7 year terms. Is that right?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. That is our sweet spot. We, every loan is a little bespoke. We take it for what it's worth on an individual project. We can go out as long as 10 or 15 years, but because we want to recycle our capital, we prefer to stay in that 2 to 7 year spot. The average duration of the loans, I think, is about 4.5 years right now. The other thing is we provide risk-adjusted capital. So we are looking at the five-year, the treasury curve from, you know, one-year treasury out to a 30-year treasury. So if it's a five-year project, we're going to start with where that five-year treasury is, and then we're going to notch it up or notch it down depending upon the risk characteristics. Obviously, a shorter loan probably has a lower interest rate, and a longer loan has a higher interest rate. But that notching factor takes into consideration both the risk of the project, and it also gives credit if they are hitting some of our statutory requirements. So we can do longer loans, but we are choosing to stay a little bit shorter because we want to recycle the capital. We also, in our lending manual, have a concentration limit that once we go beyond 10 years, we only want a small percentage of our portfolio to be there because it's really not the best use of our catalytic funding.
I'm glad to hear you using risk adjustment. So what's been your experience with your loan, their loans?
Is growth swan?
Well, we have 9 loans that have been approved all the way, money dispersed. We have 5 that have also been approved, and we are still closing on those loans. We have a very rigorous monitoring program once the money is out the door, where the finance team does quarterly reviews, annual reviews. We're constantly looking at those financial risk measurements. We haven't been in existence long enough to have a full loan get completely 100% recycled, but we are issuing invoices and collecting revenue on the loans.
So it sounds like no defaults yet.
No defaults. Okay. We have a watch list. Eric and his team have both a qualitative and a quantitative scorecard, both that we use when we're starting with the due diligence and then what we use on the ongoing monitoring process. The quantitative really looks at those debt service issues, the cash flow, the analytics. The qualitative is looking at the people, the developers, and the statutory requirements, and we are doing that on a regular basis. If in the quarterly or annual review process a loan is scored at a 3, which means it would be on our watch list, we would increase due diligence, but we don't have any loans currently on our watch list.
Thank you, Chair. Yes. Thank you.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Grosswan. So I love this, the fact that we've turned this into jobs, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I think you saw about 1,000 jobs or something. And also that the money that we've invested here in this has crowded in other investment at a 5-to-1 ratio. Can you talk about like why that is? Like why does a Mincifa have that kind of an impact? Like, I just want to understand that crowding in part, because that seems to be, you know, such a key part of this, that our dollars here can leverage into a lot more.
Ms. Grosswan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. We are called to crowd in and really leverage state dollars, but the reason it's working is that these are financially viable products in the marketplace. There are developers out there. Developers are there to make money. They're not nonprofit entities. They are there to make money, and they know that these are financially viable, important projects that are advancing our 2040 law for, 100% electric, 100% clean, affordable, reliable electricity, right? And so the crowding in happens because the marketplace is there for these types of innovative and renewable energy projects. We are also oftentimes in the capital stack, which is what we call all the pieces of a loan. Sometimes there might be a deed grant or a commerce grant or a housing grant. Sometimes there might be a grant or a philanthropic gift from like an initiative foundation. Oftentimes we're partnering with, we've worked with Sunrise, Amalgamated, Stearns County Banks, MinWest. Oftentimes there are traditional financers in the capital stack. We are providing that extra leverage that allows the projects to advance and go forward. And so we are only funding the project part that's taking care of the energy efficiency, the technology, the energy savings component.
Representative Kraft. And next we have Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Groth-Swan, for being here. This is really exciting stuff. I had two questions, so I'll just answer them or ask them right now, and then you can answer both of them. First, do you anticipate the applications will be annual? I'm just noticing that, we've put out about $40 million. We're putting in another $50 million. It's getting close to the 100-and-something million that you have in total, so curious about that. And then secondly, could you speak to the monitoring? Do you do site visits? How often are they? Can you say more there? Thanks.
Ms. Groth-Swan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. We believe that to be good stewards of our taxpayer money and to build a durable institution that needs to be self-sustaining, it is our mandate to deploy our funds. And it is a mandate because these projects are needed all across the state of Minnesota. We are crowding in other capital. We are working hard to do that. We will be bringing forward a few housekeeping statutory tweaks that just clarifies our authority this year to make sure that we are bringing as much money to these projects as we can. And we are also confident that as we continue with our outreach and our engagement plan, more and more community banks and more private funders are going to realize that we're a really good partner. We bring down the cost of capital. So we are concessionary, meaning we're below the market. So the bank might be here, we would be 1 or 2 or 3% depending upon the project below them. And then obviously philanthropy or an initiative foundation or a grant is, blending it. So the blended stack allows these, also is a reason that these projects can go forward. Eric, do you want to take the question around monitoring?
Yes. Sorry. Good afternoon. Good morning. No, afternoon. So as Carrie mentioned, the key elements of the monitoring, we have quarterly meetings with the project where we try to figure out where they are, compared to their plan, the financials, repayment, things like that. Based on that, we reassess the risk. So far, it's been going well. And then we have an in-depth annual reviews of their financials and construction plan and all of that. And that leads, again, to we recalculate some ratios and things like that. We are working right now with a very well-renowned firm to have very, very strict processes, on these quarterly reviews and annual reviews so that we can do systematic analysis. The other thing, as Carrie mentioned, when a loan is in the watch list, we have a process where then we do an in-depth analysis, we do stress analysis to see how the repayment will happen in different scenarios. So we really focus on that to make sure that we're protecting, public fundings, because ultimately we are responsible for public funds. And then there's a compliance aspect to that. We have to make sure the projects are in compliance with prevailing wages and other regulation. So we make sure that the project provide evidence that they are following this regulation. So we really have these two aspects of it.
And to answer your question, we do site visits.
And you're all done, Representative Jones. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Ms. Swan. Looking at the slide number on page 10 about the Sandstone Workforce Housing Project, the $3.6 million loan, and on the bottom it says the loan repayment is primarily federal and state historical tax credits. Now, I assume as a state agency you can't utilize tax credits. How do they become actual cash that pays back the loan?
Ms. Groth-Swan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. The tax credits actually go to the developer. They're the ones that are getting the tax credits back, and they are using those tax credit payments to pay back the loans to us. That is how that financial stream works. And then obviously there's that's how we get paid back on our investment tax credits. The other people in the capital stack are getting paid back by the rents that are coming from, the housing.
Representative Anderson, any follow-up? No. Nope. And Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on kind of just the timing. So are you making loans to entities that can't get loans from any other? Do they have to prove that they can't receive financing through any other area in order to receive or qualify for a loan through your agency?
Ms. Grosswan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. No, in fact, we want loans that are financially viable. I mean, I would say that our rigor and our due diligence on the investment team from the top of the funnel, when we go from a preliminary application through an early review application through due diligence, and then, like I said, to the credit committee and the board, I mean, we are looking at two-year audited financials at minimum. We are looking for a full source and uses of the project. We are running debt service ratios. We are running cash flow analysis. On the investment team, they are doing a best, base, and worst case scenario on what are the types of terms that we're going to go back and offer them. So, no, we want projects that are bankable. What we are doing is providing that gap financing where maybe they just can't find enough. And so we come in and say, okay, we'll provide the financing for the energy savings component, or we will incentivize you to put the energy savings component in this type of project. And so that's how we are looking at the projects. But no, we want projects that are bankable. And oftentimes, as I said, we're in the mix with other banks around the state. And, you know, these are projects that are bankable. Our money makes it go further and stretches it. So we have an example of a loan that has been approved, and we are in the process of closing it. Our $5 million allowed them to access another $45 million in capital from a bank. If they didn't have our $5 million, they probably would have gotten that full facility that they wanted. And that's going to be for that's for four projects all across the state.
Representative Sosinski.
Thank you. So, Madam Chair, it sounds like the projects would potentially, if you weren't involved, the projects would probably still be funded.
Well, I you have to remember. Oh, sorry.
No, you're fine. Go ahead.
We are bringing down the cost of capital. We are concessionary, and because we've been taking advantage of those tax credits, oftentimes we defer the payment for the first year so that tax credit can come in. So our developers are coming to us because they are getting a blended rate of capital that is cheaper than they could get from a traditional bank. Secondly, we know, and Megan Elliott, who worked on the Sandstone project, presented at a quarterly meeting that we had last week, and she said, you know, it is really hard to get access to this type of capital in greater Minnesota and rural Minnesota. And so we are right now actively working on an engagement and outreach plan to make sure that other banks outside the metro area, other banks across the state, understand that we are a financial partner with them to help them stretch their dollars, and for us to help stretch our dollars to get these really critical projects funded.
Representative Sosinski.
Thank you. And then just so you're doing, you've made loans, nine of them. Kind of what was the average size of those loans so far?
Yeah.
Ms.
Was that in the?
Thank you,
this one.
Chair. Thank you, Sosinski. Our average loan size is about $2 million. As I said, the smallest has been $500,000. The largest has been $5 million. Most of those loans fall in the duration between those 2 and 7 years. Our average interest rate on our loan currently, with the nine loans that have closed, is 4.06%. We'll call it 4%. The interesting thing that Eric prepared for me, which I love to see and I want to share with you, is of the $23 million that we've loaned out, we're going to earn in revenue when these pay back over $3.2 million. That's a 14% ROI on our money that we're earning back. So we're not only getting it paid back, but we're loaning it out at a cheap rate, but we're also getting a good ROI on those taxpayer funds.
Wow, impressive. Any other questions from members? Looks like you've done a great job of presenting the great work from MNCIFA. So thank you for doing that. I'm glad you were able to come in and share that with us today. I think there the projects that you shared, you can certainly see visions of others similar. The Sandstone workforce housing, I think, is a great example. And so thank you for all you're doing and for taking the time to come in and share that with us today. And we look forward to the continued annual reports, and you'll have to come back and keep us updated.
I will. Thank you so much for the opportunity, Chair and Representatives.
Thank you. Have a great day. And now we're going to hear a couple of bills today. Representative Kraft is going to make his way to the table. And first on the agenda is House File 2986. And we will let Representative Kraft get himself settled. Welcome to committee. And Representative Kraft, did you want to move your bill?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I would move House File 2986 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Great. And Representative Kraft, I believe you have the DE6.
I do. I'd move the DE6 and to put the bill in the shape that I would like it considered.
Wonderful. All those in favor of the DE6, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So with that, Representative Kraft, go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. So I'm excited to be here to present a couple bills today that all tie into the really important focus of affordability. The first one is on a grid efficiency perspective, and the next one will be about how to bring some solar energy affordability to individual customers. So this bill is based on a few key concepts, virtual power plants. The key concepts are, first, for utilities, reducing peaks. Peak usage can save a lot of money. Peaks are when utilities typically pay the most for energy. Second key concept is that an electron is an electron. What I mean by that is that when a utility needs power, it makes no difference whether they generate that power from a power plant or by getting it from customers, maybe from batteries, or by having customers reduce or shift their usage to another time. Third point is there's more and more devices used by people and businesses that can supply the grid energy. So think solar panels, batteries, and EVs, or are flexible in when they use energy. Think heat pumps, heat pump water heaters, smart thermostats, some appliances, and EVs and batteries again. And these class of devices I'm going to call distributed energy resources. So, again, reducing utility peaks saves money. Electron is an electron. And there's a lot of devices out there that can provide distributed energy resources. So the idea of this bill of virtual power plants is for an entity, which we'll call an aggregator, to connect to many of these distributed energy resources and through software make them taken together behave like a peaker power plant. So, like, what does that mean? So utility may say, look, I need 1 megawatt of power for an hour later today. Goes to the aggregator. The aggregator says, okay, I can send you 1 megawatt of power. I'm going to do that from 5,000 customer batteries and EVs, or I'm going to reduce energy usage by 1 megawatt for that next hour by doing a mix of 10,000 customer actions like pausing EV charging or temporarily turning down thermostats or preheating water tanks so they won't be needed during that time. Many utilities have been doing simplified versions of this for a long time with demand response programs for businesses or programs for consumers that allow them to control a device, typically like an HVAC unit, for short periods of time. Sometimes for larger loads, the demand response is even someone calling someone at a large site and saying, hey, can you turn down your thermostat? Can you pause this machine for a bit? The difference with virtual power plants is their scale and the fact that the aggregation is meant to have utilities be able to interact with them as they do power plants. Because of where these distributed energy resources are located, this bill is really focused at the distribution part of the grid. I want to review a few slides from Commerce's presentation on Thursday to show why this is so important and why it has such a potential to save ratepayers money. And now let's see if I can do this.
Yes.
All right, then I can applause.
All right. Tech guy.
All right. So this is one of the slides that Commissioner Wyckoff presented. It shows that if you look at the various trends, that generation is still quite a significant expense, but look at what's happening with distribution. Distribution costs are growing substantially. Oop. Sorry. And this is more detail. This is from 29 to 24, the change in the annual U.S. electric IOU public utility expenditures. So you see the change, generation is going down, transmission costs are going up, but the largest part going up is distribution. And here's one of the, I pointed this out on Thursday, but this shows the correlation between more load growth and the potential to lower retail prices. And the reason that this is so is that if you think about it, if you have a set of wires, right, a set of facility, and you can put more load on it without building other stuff, then it drives rates down. Virtual power plants are about using the grid we have more efficiently. So that's what this has so much potential. And this last slide was talking about how we can meet the need. We have a growing need on the grid for more power. And how do we meet that grid? Well, renewables and storage are fast to deploy. Other options out there take quite a bit of time. But if you look on the right here, what's the fastest way we can do things that can address the load and lower costs? Energy efficiency, you see demand response and virtual power plants. Okay. So that's why I think this, what we're talking about here, is so important. And specifically, according to a Department of Energy 2025 report, virtual power plants are solutions that can be deployed at scale in a short time frame to maximize the use and value of existing grid infrastructure, minimize costs to ratepayers, and ensure a resilient, reliable, and secure grid. Estimates are that virtual power plants could provide 10 to 20% of peak load annually by 2030, which would save $10 to $20 billion in annual grid costs across the country. So that's the potential here. So on to the bill. At a high level, what the bill does is it says that public utilities in Minnesota must reduce their system peak, the highest cost time of the day for them, must reduce their system peak with a virtual power plant program and reduce it by 5% by the end of 2028 and 10% by the end of 2032. They must do this by getting bids in a request for proposal process run by an independent third party. This is to make sure that all aggregators, including utilities if they so wish, have the information they need to bid and that all are on an equal footing. So get it out and let the market pick the best. Virtual power plant plans must be built into a public utilities integrated resource plan filing, so we're trying to merge into existing systems. And we include, I'll call a savings clause in there, like we did in the 2040 law that said the PUC can relax the requirements if they are shown to not be technically or financially feasible. So with that, Madam Chair, I'd like to, I've got some testifiers.
Yes, looks like there's several.
Oh, I forgot to turn on my microphone. There's several on the list. First, we have Sydney Lieb, Assistant Commissioner from the Minnesota Department of Commerce. Please make your way to the table. Welcome to committee. Go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
You're good.
It's live.
There you go.
Thank you, Chair Akam and members of the committee. Co-chairs Akam and Wazinski, members of the committee, my name's Assistant Commissioner Sydney Lieb, and I'm here to testify on HF 292986 on behalf of the Department of Commerce. Virtual power plants, or VPPs, aggregate and manage distributed generation, storage, and demand response, so that these distributed resources function like a grid-scale generation resource. VPPs are an important tool that can rapidly improve the capacity constraints on our grid by making use of new and existing distributed generation, storage, and demand response. These resources can be deployed when energy system needs are at their peak and can reduce energy costs by avoiding expensive peak resources or market purchases when demand is high across the region, which significantly drives energy spot prices. The value of resources that can mitigate energy demand at system peak has become even more important since MISO, which is the interregional market that most of the state participates in, recently implemented market reforms to align market price signals with demand. The most recent MISO auction saw peak demand prices over $600 per megawatt day, and for context, prices are typically below 100 megawatt during non-peak times. With the legislation passed last year to support data center development and the announcement this morning, Minnesota is likely to see electric load growth at least partially driven by data center development in the state, as well as other demand growth from other economic development opportunities. One challenge in meeting the energy demand of these large customers will be the ability to bring on generation resources online at pace with the data center development and demand growth. We anticipate that supply chain constraints in grid scale generators, continued economic dislocation from federal policies such as tariffs, and general federal hostility to wind and solar, the type of generation that can be built most quickly, and other federal actions, as well as delays in the MISO interconnection queue, may create challenges in an increasing generation to meet the growing demand. The Department of Commerce supports an all-of-the-above approach to achieving the state's 0x40 clean electricity requirement, and this includes virtual power plants. Virtual power plants can provide low-cost, clean, firm power by utilizing existing generation, storage, and demand response resources on the distribution system located in and near large load and population centers. This evades the need for transmission investments, and for this reason, VPPs can be an important source of low-cost energy. This bill addresses traditional utility incentive structures that underinvest historically in demand response. Vertically integrated utilities are incentivized to build transmission and generation infrastructure and prefer these investments over alternative investments such as demand response and virtual power plants that can avoid more capital and costly capital investments. Given the misalignment of incentives that favor large investments over distributed system investments and non-wires alternatives, utilities will underinvest and have historically underinvested in VPPs and DR without a policy signal to make these investments more appropriate. This bill would encourage further development of the virtual power plant ecosystem in Minnesota to further benefit us all through lower energy bills and increased reliability and resilience. Virtual power plants can leverage existing utility system investments in the distribution grid and improve grid utilization to make these investments more cost-effective for customers. The proposed approach sets a standard and then put out an RFP to see how the system can most effectively secure these resources needed in line with existing utility and regulatory oversight procedures. This legislation stipulates that this process be run through a neutral third party so as to reassure ratepayers that the most cost-effective pathway to meet this capacity need are procured. This is part of the consumer protection that we see as essential for ratepayers. In addition to this essential consumer protection, we also note that the bill has additional consumer protection provisions in the legislation. The first is that the department provides appropriate and reasonable consumer protections and standards for entry into a virtual power plant program, included but not limited to requirements for standard contract terms and disclosure forms, payment terms, and warranties. In addition, the provision in the VPP program requirements spell out key features that must be attended to with VPPs, including how often a VPP can be dispatched, when and over what duration the notice requirements and opt-out process will occur, and as well as how compensation rates for participants will be determined. The department and me are available for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Leaf. Next on the list is Patty O'Keefe, Regional Director for Midwest Vote Solar. Welcome to committee. It's wonderful to see you.
Yeah.
Please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Acom, and thank you to, Chairs Acom and Swadinsky. My name is Patty O'Keefe. I am the Midwest Regional Director with Vote Solar. I want to thank Representative Kraft for advancing this bill in a broader conversation on virtual power plants. Virtual power plants, or VPPs for short, are a really exciting innovation in energy that are already making a lot of strides across the country and making energy more affordable and the grid more reliable. And they are also a bit wonky. And so you did a great job with breaking it down. I'm going to try and break it down even a bit more. So if you can imagine a neighborhood where people have solar panels on their roofs or an EV charger in their garage or a smart thermostat in their home, and these people voluntarily decide to be part of a network of that brings all of those devices together, that network uses software to, bring all of the power of those technologies together and shift the energy to where it needs to go on the grid to meet demand. The entity that is actually running the software and like coordinating where all of these different resources go is called an aggregator. So hence the name. You can think of VPPs like a power plant, but made up of small devices, you know, that are brought together. And for being part of a network as a customer, you get compensated for the value that your home energy system brings to the grid. If that still feels a little complicated, think of virtual power plants like an orchestra. In this scenario, the instruments are the rooftop solar, the batteries, the smart thermostats. The conductor is the aggregator in the center, calling on different instruments at different times, helping them all work together to create a beautiful supply of musical energy to your ears. That was my best shot at a... VPPs are especially helpful during times of peak demand when people are using the most energy. So, for example, on a hot summer day, when people get home from work and everyone starts running their air conditioners, there may not be enough supply of energy on the system to meet the demand. And in those cases, we often will turn on our gas peaker plants, whose purpose has been to fill those gaps and to make sure we still have reliable power on those high demand days. While peaker plants play an important role in system reliability, they also do come at a cost. They're between 35 and 45% less efficient than a regular gas plant, which means they burn a lot more fuel, between 60 and 70% more fuel as a regular gas plant to produce the same amount of electricity. This makes them amongst the most expensive sources of electricity on the system, oftentimes costing 2 to 4 times more per megawatt hour than renewables or more efficient gas plants. So with rising load growth, increasing extreme weather, and an affordability crisis, we need all the tools in our toolbox. And VPPs are a practical market-based tool to make use of existing resources to reduce waste on the system and save ratepayers money. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Keefe. And instead of tools in the toolbox, isn't it instruments in the orchestra?
Instruments in the orchestra, yeah. I'll stay more committed to that.
All right, thank you. Next on the list, we have Bobby King, State Policy Director for Solar United Neighbors. Welcome to committee, Mr. King. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for committee, and go ahead.
Thank you, Co-Chair Aiken. My name is Bobby King. I'm the Minnesota State Director for Solar United Neighbors. Just wanted to add a few points to what's already been well said. We've found that with solar and solar and batteries policy has not really kept up with what technology makes possible, what the industry can deliver, and what consumers want. So this bill takes a big step in rectifying some of that. And for me, one of the most exciting things about VPPs is the only thing to keep them from working in Minnesota is the right policy framework. And with that policy framework that's proposed in this bill, we can quickly realize savings for all ratepayers. It's estimated that 35% of all solar installations are going to include batteries in the future. And one thing that VPPs do is they take that private investment that's not being utilized to its full potential, and they figure out a way that not only does that battery owner benefit and get a financial incentive, but all ratepayers can get a benefit through this VPP system. We've got a financial analyst at Sun that took a look at the best research out there on potential VPP savings and applied it to XL Energy territory. And I submitted some longer comments that are in your packet, I hope, and online. But by that estimate, using Minnesota-specific situation, we estimate if in 2030, if we meet 10% of our peak demand with VPPs, the savings will be $63.5 million. That'd be about $50 a customer. And of course, folks that are enrolled in the VPP program will save even more. So there's a lot of potential here that we can unlock with this approach. And we look forward to working with this as it advances. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King. Next we have on the list Jessica Fishman with Renewable Energy, as the Renewable Energy Director with Kite Rocket. Welcome to committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Hi, thank you for having me. My name is Jessica Fishman. I've been working in electrotech for the past 15 plus years. As part of that experience, I was able to launch one of the first VPP solutions. I want to reiterate really how cool virtual power plants are for grid modernization and expansion. Our energy infrastructure has stayed nearly the same for a century. We focused on, and VPPs are a massive leap forward. Typically, we have energy produced at one central location and then transmitted out to where it's consumed. What VPPs do is they move production, consumption, and storage to the same location, and then are aggregating and coordinating all these energy resources that are distributed so that they can operate as one large power plant. They transform our grid into an interconnected distributed network that is really proactive. As already mentioned, they can include batteries, but they can also include a number of other resources, EVs, water heaters, thermostats. They not only supply or store extra energy, but also reduce demand. It almost feels like sci-fi, but it's not. VPPs have already been deployed in Massachusetts, California, Utah, Puerto Rico, North and South Carolina. They're already providing reductions for ratepayers and cutting costs for utilities. VPPs can act as a cheap peaker plant. When energy demand is going to be high, for instance, it's a hot day, during the morning, they can charge up the batteries and then discharge the batteries when it's much hotter to help power air conditioners. That means there's less stress on transmission and distribution lines, and it can even defer and completely avoid having to build costly T&D upgrades. But VPPs are better than just peaker plants. They're more flexible and they're cheaper. They can improve reliability, they maintain grid frequency, they help with voltage control, they can hedge against pricing volatility, they can reduce congestion on transmission lines. They support energy trading, provide backup power. Using a VPP solely for peak shaving would be like buying a car and only using it to go to the grocery store and not go anywhere else with it. VPPs essentially turn energy appliances into grid resources versus grid strains. According to the Brattle Group, the benefits of a similar program in California significantly outweigh the program's costs, providing a potential net system cost savings of up to $206 million between 2025 and 2028. Thank you for your time and consideration. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. And last on the list, we have Sarah Webby from Mincia. There she is. Welcome to committee, Ms. Webby. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Co-Chair Acom, committee members. My name is Sarah Webby, Director of Policy and Regulatory Affairs for Mencia. I'm here today to speak in support of House File 2986, and I want to speak plainly about what this bill has the potential to do for every Minnesotan who pays an electric bill. Minnesota ratepayers are facing compounding cost pressures due to increasing costs for distribution infrastructure. And we've already seen record rate increases across the state. As the Deputy Commissioner of Energy Resources shared in this committee last week, with federal clean energy funding now at risk, independent analysts project that Minnesota energy bills could increase by 10% by as soon as 2029. And that is the trajectory that we're on without intervention. Virtual power plants are a cost intervention. By coordinating customer-sited solar, batteries, EVs, smart thermostats, and water heaters to reduce demand during peak hours, VPPs cut expensive wholesale market purchases and defer infrastructure investments that drive rate increases. They also reduce reliance on costly peakers precisely at the moment when prices are highest. We know that this works because other states have done it. Where VPP programs have been implemented, the results are consistent. Benefit-to-cost ratios well above 1-to-1, which means that ratepayers receive more in system benefits than the program costs to operate. The dominant driver of those benefits is avoided capacity costs. Generation and infrastructure that never gets built because the VPP handled the peak instead. Real-world performance data shows that distributed battery fleets coordinated at scale can deliver the equivalent output of a large generating plant during actual grid stress events, not just in models. On resilience, Minnesota's extreme weather demands a grid that can withstand beyond normal stress. Distributed resources spread across thousands of homes have no single point of failure. That architecture is fundamentally more resilient than dependence on a handful of large centralized plants. This bill provides a strong foundation, but it could go further. The greatest ratepayer benefits will come not from utilities running their own programs, but from robust third-party ownership and aggregation. In this new era of decentralized energy infrastructure, competition will drive down costs, privatize risk, and accelerate enrollment. This bill creates a framework to make use of infrastructure already being installed here today to reduce costs for all ratepayers and strengthen the grid, and I urge you to support it. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Webby. Is there anyone else that would like to speak to this bill today? Doesn't look like it. So we'll maybe turn to questions from committee members. I actually have one that I don't know if Representative Kraft, you can respond to, or one of the testifiers, but I think it was Ms. Fishman who said that VPPs can be like a cheaper peaker plant. And so I'm wondering, given that this is policy that has been deployed in other states, do we have any kind of estimate as to how much cheaper? I know it may be variable. It may be, are there any, you know, just high level estimates about how much cheaper?
Madam Chair, I don't know relative to a specific peaker plant. I don't know if one of the testifiers, if you do come on up, I will say that in the analysis of what this can save from peak costs is that if we could do 10 to 20% of peak load annually, it's $10 to $20 billion around the country, and that's primarily coming from those. But yeah. Of the specific, like peaker versus not, I don't have that.
Mr. King, I see you raising your hand. Go ahead and make your way to the table, please. And again, introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Bobby King, the State Director for Solar United Neighbors. In the information I provided to the committee, we did an analysis, and it's on a fact sheet. It's the last page. So if you go to the bottom, there's a graph there that shows the cost of running a VPP versus the benefits versus the cost of running a peaker cost in XL territory versus the benefits. And that's how we came up with the $65 million savings. And that, do folks have that?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, sorry, it's...
No, there's a lot of stuff that was submitted, so...
Yeah, it's the very last page of what I submitted. So this comes from the Brattle Group's large report applied specifically to Minnesota. So that's not a specific peaker, but peakers in general versus VPPs and the numbers for Minnesota.
Great.
In XL territory.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing this forward. I know we talked about this a little bit this summer, and, you know, I guess I'm kind of curious, what do our IOUs think about this, and how are they implementing it? I think I had heard earlier that they're starting to do this now. What government likes to do a lot is mandate these things on the go so we can push it harder and faster so it becomes reality. And I think that's kind of what I'm hearing this bill is attempting to do. Technology is getting there, and I think that I've heard that, again, XL Energy, for example, is utilizing this now. I'm curious, and maybe XL wants to come forward and kind of just give me an idea or us an idea about where are they at now in this program. What concerns me about putting this forward, if this were to pass and it's in law, I know you had some off-ramps that if, look, the PUC can say, look, if this isn't quite ready, we got an off-ramp. But between now and then, before they say if there is an off-ramp, if that's what it comes to be, they have spent gobs and gobs of money to get it to that point to say this isn't going to work like you think it will right now today. So my question only is this, is that if I wouldn't mind asking XL, Madam Chair, if that's all right to ask that question. I know I'm putting them on the spot. If they want to say, no, Baker, I'm not doing it, I get it, that's fine. But I think this is important conversation to understand. We're driving our biggest providers of energy to a system that has really good technology. I'm not opposed to the technology. I'm not opposed to what this is going to do. But how will it work for the ratepayers, how it naturally can kind of work in the system versus being kind of forced ahead of time? That's where I'm having a lot of heartburn on this, Representative Kraft, is we're pushing it a little quicker than I think that naturally would want to happen best is if it's done at a natural level. So you can answer that, or if we can go right to XL, whatever you want to do, Representative Kraft.
Mr. Pearson, I appreciate you coming to committee. I know you didn't sign up to testify, and so appreciate your willingness to answer a few questions or provide a little input. And Representative Kraft, did you want to respond to Representative Baker or?
Madam Chair, well, I'll let Mr. Pearson
go
first, and then I have a few comments.
Great.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and just for the record, Jim Pearson with XL Energy. You know, I've enjoyed listening to the conversation today, and I think I would make a couple of points. First being, we've been talking with Representative Kraft about the bill for a long time, several months. I mean, that's the one thing we do enjoy about this committee is being able to sort of interact on the details. Representative Baker, to your point, I do agree that our preference would be to have a less prescriptive direction coming from the legislature and allow us the flexibility to go down this path, sort of to get a high direction or a high policy signal from the legislature and let the details get sorted out through regulatory processes. That is the path that we are currently on. The virtual power plant proposal that we have in front of the commission now, we refer to as Capacity Connect. That was born out of an IRP settlement. So from that perspective, the direction and the focus of the conversation, you know, again, to your point, we are very engaged in that and going down the path. I would remind the committee that when we filed that, there was, I think most of you, if not all legislators, got some email about cost concerns with our program. And I know, Representative Baker, you and I had a follow-up conversation about some of the email that you had received from constituents who were expressing the cost concerns about our program. I'm happy to get into the details, but that is the point that I guess I'd really like to drive home from today and for the committee, is the details matter. Some of the virtual power plant
programs are not cost-effective. Some of them may be. It is critical to understand how those calculations are made, and that's what we do when we submit a filing to the commission. We go through that process and prove it out. And so, again, I'm just advocating for a conversation that is maybe less prescriptive and allows the utilities to come forward with proposals and work that out in a very public process, which the commission has and which we want to use for that type of detailed conversation.
Mr. Pearson, I certainly appreciate those comments, and I think if I recall from some of the cost concerns that came up in response to Capacity Connect, part of that concern is that the utility is going to be owning all of the resources for that rather than having it on a maybe competitively open market kind of situation. And so maybe a little bit of difference in model, but appreciate that. Representative Baker, did you have a follow-up?
Madam Chair, I wasn't sure if Rep Kraft wanted to respond to that.
Representative Kraft.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Baker. I really appreciate the thoughtful question, and Mr. Pearson, we have spoken a lot about this, and we'll continue, right? So that's something that I commit to as part of this. A few things to think about. I think if we were to ask Assistant Commissioner Lee back up here and were to ask her, and maybe we should, about demand response performance, what I've heard over time is that the IOUs have consistently underperformed on the where folks would want them from a demand response perspective. So that's the precursor to virtual power plants. So we have an example of maybe not performing to where we would want them to do in terms of, and that can be a cost saving. You talked about, you know, is it going to be gobs of money? What I would say is we're not the first state to do this. This is happening in many other places, and we can build on that. So these are, it's known how to do these things. The Capacity Connect proposal from Xcel, I applaud their creativity in trying to use batteries more within their network. It's different than the bill that I have here. There, the Capacity Connect is a front of meter thing versus a back of meter. That means that Xcel would own these, and they would not be used by the customer at all, but it would just be co-located on a customer site, and they would use them to balance out things going on in the grid. The virtual power plants that I'm talking about are quite a different kind of a thing, aggregating the customer side. And lastly, in terms of less prescriptive, I appreciate that. I mean, I have a long background in the tech industry and appreciate the private market. But the IOUs are monopolies. Their incentive structure are set up, just the way they earn money is by building things. And what we've seen over time is they have done less of this kind of thing than we would like them to do that can be effective for customers. So I think it is our responsibility as with a monopoly provider to say, we demand a bit more of you. We're going to have the off ramps there for you to be able to get off if it turns out not. But we're basing on what other people are doing, and I think we can ask our utilities, given their monopoly status, to step up a bit and save our ratepayers more money.
Just a quick follow-up, Madam Chair. Thanks. And I appreciate both of you responding to that. Just inquisitive question that I have, because again, technology is coming. I hope that someday in Minnesota we'll also have more carbon-free baseload, which is nuclear, someday on our grid, that we can use that also to help our system. But I think what your program is trying to do is to try to not build more things so that we can utilize what's there. I know, talking with our partners that are trying to figure out how do we work through this net metering program, and batteries now are becoming a huge part of that because we want to balance out the load. If we have a perfect system, we know exactly when the load is coming and the demand, and that is the secret sauce I know that we're trying to get to. I'm just, again, wanting to warn all of us that what starts with the IOUs ends up with the munis and the co-ops, and I'm concerned that down the road that is going to be something that could be. And again, I'm just sharing that concern, because it's all about, we all want to make sure that we utilize our current grid system more efficiently so we don't have to build more plants. But I just wanted to put that out there because, again, this has got maybe future potential, but I just hate pushing industry to a point where it's going to end up costing much more money than we're ready to do a fair rate of return. So I appreciate that indulgence. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative
Madam
Baker.
Chair. Could I just?
Representative Kraft.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Baker, 2 points. This bill is focused at the IOUs. Because the munis and co-ops have a just different incentive structure, we generally see them taking more advantage of stuff like this. So I don't foresee this going down there because their incentive structure is just different. And the other thing I would say is we are going to need to build a lot more stuff, right? We're going to need to build more transmission. We're going to need to build more, you know, power generating things. With the low growth that we're seeing from data centers, EVs over time are going to dominate that. So I am not we're going to do this and never going to have to build more things. We're going to have to build more things, but we should take advantage of every tool we have in the toolbox. And this is a way we can get more capacity rapidly and lower costs. So
thank you. Mr. Pearson, briefly.
Madam Chair, thanks for a final opportunity. We've talked a little bit about incentive structures, and I guess I just wanted to add to that. We take our role as building infrastructure to power the state's economy very seriously. And I believe that from all of, whether you're an investor-owned utility, a co-op, a municipality. And so the incentives there are really about powering the state's economy safely, reliably, and affordable. Representative Kraft talked about our defined service territories. As Utilities in Minnesota, we all have them. The only way I can grow is by doing a good job and incenting customers to locate within our territory. I can't expand geographically, but I can be affordable, reliable, sustainable, et cetera. So we take those charges to heart. They mean a lot in terms of how we grow and in this environment. Now, I started with Xcel in 2011. I've never worked for the company where we've been in a growth environment, where we've had significant load growth around the corner. That is a key piece to trying to maintain some level of affordability, because if we have more kilowatt hours to divide our costs across, it helps all of our customers in lowering the upward pressure on rates that is coming through the investments that we're making. So I would love the opportunity to continue to talk about that, and I just want to put a plug in for our incentives really are about powering the state's economy in that manner. So I appreciate the additional time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pearson. Next on the list, we have Representative Jones.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kraft, for bringing this forward. As we were talking about technology and should we be pushing our monopolies to be adopting certain technologies, it made me actually remember, back in 1994, we were talking about nuclear and Prairie Island and storing casks of nuclear waste and all of that. And as a part of that negotiation, we had the renewable development account that was developed. We talked, there was the decisions around nuclear. But another key piece to that was that there was a requirement for 100 megawatts of wind to be built in Minnesota. So we required that of Xcel. I don't know how they felt about it at the time, but as a result of that, they built it, and then they realized it was cost effective. And so I think it behooves us to learn from that example that, especially when we have a regulatory compact, and these are regulated monopolies, we have a duty to continue to push the envelope and innovate so that we can keep costs down. Now, wind power is 25% of our load in Minnesota. And so we've seen the fantastic success. And I think, we're not guinea pigs when it comes to VPPs. And so I think we can be pretty self-assured that we're not going to, suddenly see costs explode because of this. We should actually see the opposite. And so, especially given the regulatory compact and with monopoly utilities, and we're doing this in a public process, I do want to call out, Mr. Pearson had said,
maybe we should be doing this through the PUC in a public process there. Well, this is a public process. This is a public public meeting. We've got elected officials here. The PUC is not elected. I think this is the most public process that we could have in order to set up a VPP policy. And so I just want to thank Representative Kraft for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
And last question to Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just kind of more of a couple of comments. I appreciate this conversation. It's my understanding that Governor Newsom vetoed a VPP bill in 2025 in California with concerns on it. And here we go again, right? So we already have a bill that calls for carbon-free power by 2040. It's a mandate. And we're saying, go out and figure it out, utilities, but we're going to tell you exactly how to get there as a legislative body. Rather than allowing markets to work, like we were told that this is a market-based solution, well, then why do we need to mandate it? Thank you.
Final question to Representative Sexton. Sorry.
Thanks. I have two, if you don't mind, ma'am.
Yes, of course.
First of all, I was wondering if MISO was invited because we talked about electrons go with the path of least resistance, and they're crossing borders all the time, and we're part of a bigger MISO network, which this bill and this decision could significantly impact. So I think we're incomplete in our testimony without a MISO perspective on what we do with the VPP. Second point, I read some very interesting articles back around 2010 on VPPs using automobile batteries. It was written by the Northwest National Lab. Then this summer, I had the opportunity to go out there, take some classes, and I said, hey, it's been 16 years, excuse me. What happened with that? They said, well, we were going to build this whole network of you plug in your car when you get home from work, and then you go to work, and you plug in your car, and you buy and sell all day long. You could take your battery down to 80%. You could take it only down to 50%, whatever you wanted to program in your car. And then they came back and said, when we actually tested it, which is part of a VPP, it burned out the batteries much faster than they ever imagined. So it increased the cost significantly of replacing the car and the car battery. So they pretty much dropped that portion of it, which battery parts or batteries are a significant portion of a VPP to minimize your peak load. So just wanted to bring that out, that even the people who research this all the time are kind of backing off from the batteries.
And we're going to maybe give Representative Kraft a moment to respond, but I will say part of it is when you use the battery and also when you charge the battery. So it can be variable about both. Representative Kraft.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Is this the final comments on the bill?
Yeah, I don't see any other questions.
Okay,
so, yeah, go ahead. You can respond to Representative Sexton.
Thank you. So, this bill is targeted at the distribution side of the grid, not the wholesale side of the grid, which is why I didn't spend as much time with myself. But I'm happy to reach out with you if you'd like to get a perspective on that. And the bill isn't saying what kind of technology needs to be used for VPPs. Some of the most successful ones that I've seen in many other places are using batteries. Sometimes there's some really cool business models that are out there where an aggregator will put a battery on a customer site and say, hey, you can use it and we can use it. And they're very successful. So I'll share those with you. Thank you for this really excellent conversation, committee members. The question is, what I'm excited about here is this targets the most costly part of a utility's usage. It focused on the area of the grid where costs are growing fastest, and it allows us to go after in places that are historically underinvested because public utility, and I really appreciate that Xcel is trying to do their best, but they are just incented to make money for their shareholders, which is about building things, and this is not that. So that is why that I think a mandate here of saying, do a bit of this makes perfect sense. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kraft. And with that, the bill is laid over. And since you're there, we'll move on to House File 3555.
I'd like to move 3555 to be possible inclusion.
Laid over for possible inclusion. There you go.
Got it.
Great. Go ahead, Representative Kraft. Please tell us about your other bill.
All right. So I am excited to talk about this bill that can make the affordability and other benefits of solar energy directly accessible to many more people. In nearly all places of the world today, solar energy is the cheapest way to produce new electricity, and it keeps getting cheaper because it's on a technology learning curve. Solar panel costs have dropped 90% in the past decade, reducing roughly 20% for each doubling of capacity, and there's no reason to think that's going to stop. Solar was 66% of all new electricity generating capacity added to the U.S. grid in 2024. Over 5% of Minnesota's electricity is now from solar, coming up from less than 1% barely a decade ago. But over 70% of Americans today can't access solar individually, maybe because they rent their where they live, or maybe their rooftops don't work, maybe they're shaded, have too much shade, or wouldn't support solar panels, or they can't get good financing. What this bill does, plug-in solar, is really opens up who can participate in the affordability revolution of solar. With plug-in solar, it can connect directly to a home outlet, whether that be in a backyard, on a deck, or on a balcony. So solar energy can flow into your home's electric circuit and reduce the electricity you get from the grid. It typically saves 5 to 25% of a home's usage, depending on the size of the system and the size of the home, talking about savings of, you know, $35 to $55 per month. There's dramatically lower upfront costs. Systems can start at sub $1,000 and go up to a few thousand. And now what the bill is doing is really signaling that Minnesota is open for plug-in solar. Specifically from a technical perspective, it defines a plug-in solar device as having a maximum, as having a maximum power output of 1,200 watts, and that system can include storage. By the way, 1,200 watts is less than most hair dryers. And that it's certified to a new and tested to a new U.S. standard that has recently come out for these systems. The standard is UL 3700 from United Laboratories, and that handles all of the electrical safety concerns around this. From a process perspective, what the bill does is it exempts plug-in solar devices from needing a utility interconnection agreement, and also exempts it from being able to participate in net metering. So you offset your energy usage. If you use more, you don't get extra credit for that. It just offsets your energy usage. I will also mention that this bill is one of the things I've gotten the most interest in from folks. There's a lot of support in your packet from folks ranging from Avote Solar, Solar United Neighbors, MinSEA, Minnesota Interfaith Power and Light, Minnesota Efficient Building Coalitions, the Conservative Energy Network, and the Clear Energy Coalition. The first bill in the country passed in Utah last year, unanimously led by a Republican, and there are approximately 29 other states that are considering this right now. So excited to bring this to you all and hope we can, help to facilitate this really exciting new market in Minnesota.
Great. Thank you, Representative Kraft. We've got a number of speakers. First two are online, and so we'll ask Mr. Wesley Schrock from Brightsaver to unmute yourself, and then you can go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the House Energy Finance and Policy Committee. My name is Wesley Schrock, representing brightsaver.org, a California-based nonprofit dedicated to building a plug-in solar movement in the U.S., making solar ownership affordable and accessible to everyone. We run pilot programs installing plug-in systems to see what works and what doesn't, and to gather savings data. We also work on policy, supporting state-level enabling legislation. I am testifying to encourage the committee to support HF 3555 to allow the people of Minnesota to access plug-in solar, saving money by reducing their electricity bills. This is a market-driven solution requiring no tax credits or public funds. It's just cutting red tape. Importantly, Minnesota will be joining a national movement and in so doing, building a market for plug-in solar in the U.S. As Representative Kraft mentioned, last year, Utah was the first state to pass legislation enacting HB 340, a bipartisan budget-neutral regulatory reform, exempting plug-in solar from interconnection. And immediately, two companies began selling plug-in solar systems in Utah. This year, already 29 states have introduced legislation, with a few more expected to do so. In our conversations with manufacturers, both those selling in Utah and those sitting on the sidelines, with five or six more states on board, they will expand their product offerings or enter the U.S. for the first time, selling in all states with legislation, including Minnesota. Given the sizable demand, we model that competition will drive system costs below $1 per watt, with payback periods declining to 2 to 4 years. And then lastly, in December of last year, the first system-level safety standard for plug-in solar in the U.S. was released by Underwriters Laboratories, one of the country's preeminent standards development organizations. That standard, UL 3700, is a set of rigorous requirements and tests to ensure that plug-in systems will not shock users, overload circuits, or create fire hazards, backfeed during a power outage, which protects line workers and anyone working on a multi-unit building, and they will be mounted safely and in a safe location, i.e. not blocking egress. And then in January, UL announced a testing and certification program for plug-in solar, and we know that companies are already working on getting products listed to UL 3700. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Schrock. Next, we have John Gokey with Star Power Electric. Again, please go ahead and unmute yourself and proceed.
Hi there. My name is John Gokey. I own and operate Star Power Electric, a small electrical business in Duluth, specializing in solar batteries and backup power. I support this bill, HF 3555, not only because it will grant Minnesotans greater freedom over their energy, but because it's safe. I work with this stuff in theory and practice on a daily basis. And the 1200 watt limit in combination with the UL listing gives me a 100% certainty that this is a safe bill. Like Kraft said, hair dryers can draw 1800 watts, and that goes through the similar UL listing process. 1800 watts is about 15 amps. That would overload a 15 amp circuit. 15 amp circuit is the smallest circuit in a house typically. So 1200 watts at 10 amps is safe for plug-in solar. In addition, you don't have the issue where, you know, if you had multiple loads plugged into one circuit, you could overload it. At 1200 watts with solar, you actually don't have that same issue because the solar relieves pressure on the electrical system. So the breaker, if the breaker feeding a circuit had a 10 amp microwave and then also 10 amps of solar on it, at the breaker, there'd be 0 amps. To the grid, there would be 0 amps. This is safe legislation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gakey. Next, we have Patty O'Keefe with Vote Solar. Welcome back. Go ahead and reintroduce yourself.
Hi again. Thank you to members of the committee for listening to me speak twice. I'm Patty O'Keefe with Vote Solar. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for House File 3555 on plug-in solar. I've been an advocate around energy issues for, probably 15 years, and I have never experienced so much, genuine kind of organic excitement around a solution that I have with plug-in solar. People are reaching out to our organization who have never been affiliated with us, and they're like, so we want to learn more about this. When we're talking with people about this out at events, people's eyes light up, and they're like, oh, yeah, that's exciting. I want that. I understand why, because, you know, if you're a renter and you don't have control over where your energy is coming from, or maybe you live in a house that isn't suitable for rooftop solar, plug-in solar, it helps make solar more accessible for people who want more control over their energy generation or are looking for kind of a cushion against these rising energy costs. And yeah, it's simple. The bill authorizes systems that are pretty small. The upper cap for wattage is about the same wattage of your like household blender. And there's no energy produced from the panels that is going back onto the grid. They're just offsetting the use in your own home. So yeah, there's so much excitement from the public on this technology. Plug-in solar bills across the country have been able to, you know, pass with bipartisan support, even Republican leadership. So whether you have a balcony, a deck, patio, some backyard space, plug-in solar, it's simple, safe, consumer-driven, and is a step that kind of meets people where they're at and allows them to generate their own power in like a small but meaningful way. So for those reasons, we'd ask for your support for House File 3555. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. O'Keefe. Next, we have Evan Mulholland. Make your way to the table, please. And next after that will be Emma Feist.
If I can mention that there's a handout that folks have that shows pictures of some of these.
So yes.
Just so you know,
go ahead, please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Evan Mulholland, and I'm a renter in Minneapolis, and I'm here to ask for your support for this bill. I'm really excited. As soon as this becomes legal, I plan to buy one, and I love solar energy. When I used to own a house, I had solar panels on top, and now I rent. So I really want to like have solar energy available to me. And I learned a lot from the other testifiers and from talking to Patty and Vote Solar. So that's the end of my testimony. I hope that you can support this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I appreciate your brevity. Next we have Emma Feist. Please go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name's Emma Feist, and I'm a fourth-year student at the U of M, and I'm also a renter in Richfield. I believe that balcony solar would be helpful for me, as it would help cut energy costs, as well as allow me to directly invest in green infrastructure. And we all know that energy costs are rising, and I know that it's not just my household that is feeling this burden. So as someone who is a student without a lot of disposable income, this is one way that I can personally offset my carbon footprint, and that's without having to spend more money, as we know that a lot of sustainable and green products tend to actually cost more for the average consumer. I think the implementation of balcony solar panels will be a large incentive for the general public to utilize green energy. And as we know, getting consumers to invest in green energy often can cost money, and that's not a very helpful incentive structure for many people just like me who don't have the disposable income to spend extra on green products. And yeah, it's hard to justify spending what I have to invest in that kind of stuff. But as this incentive structure allows me to make my money back, that would be very helpful for me. I was also going to say, I think this is very special because of this incentive structure. I hear so many innovative solutions at school about how they can use carbon dioxide to make plastic, use that carbon and make polymers out of it. And then I know I will never hear about it again, because all of the money that gets put into these innovations will actually never come to fruition because of the structures that we have. So I believe that cutting this red tape and letting this pass would be a very important way that consumers and households can save money.
Thank you, Ms. Feist. And we have Will Mulren with Fresh Energy. Sorry if I said your last name wrong. You're going to correct me here in just a minute. Please go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Chairs Acomb and Swidzinski and committee members. My name is Will Mulhern. I'm here to provide comments on behalf of Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a 30-year-old Minnesota-based nonpartisan, not-for-profit organization. We work to shape and drive bold policy solutions to achieve equitable carbon-neutral economies, and we appreciate the opportunity to offer perspectives on House File 3555. Fresh Energy supports the adoption of this bill, removing barriers to the deployment of plug-in solar in Minnesota. We believe plug-in solar can be a useful technology for offsetting some household demand for electricity, essentially functioning as an energy efficiency measure. that can reduce the need for grid-delivered electricity at certain times. This serves the dual purpose of helping reduce household electricity bills and potentially reducing the amount of utility-scale generation needed to meet demand. Because they cost less than rooftop panels, these systems are expected to have shorter payback periods, meaning adopters can recover upfront costs more quickly through reductions in their energy bills. For some households, this could mean accessing solar technology, or this could make solar technology financially attainable for the first time. And finally, we appreciate the requirement for certification from Underwriters Laboratories or an equivalent organization. Ensuring safety for households as well as those working on our electricity system is essential, and requiring the certification will ensure these technologies can be safely deployed in Minnesota households. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this and to explain Fresh Energy's support for plug-in solar in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. And I think there may be one other person who wants to, what's that? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? No? Okay. Oh, yep. If you could be brief, we've got just a couple minutes left.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak again. My name is Jessica Fishman. I just want to frame this as a property rights argument. I can't imagine ever having to ask government to plug in a washer or dryer. I think anybody should have the, just as they have the ability to light a fire in their home, that they should also have the ability to produce their own energy.
Thank you for that. That's a good point. Then, any questions? Representative Igo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Kraft, for the bill. I guess I'm just going to kind of like speak some comments I have. I won't say I'm necessarily opposed or for the bill, per se, at this time. The first thing, and because I have to say it when we talk about the lowering cost of solar, I did some research for the bill, right? I mean, 80% of these plug-in solar modules come from China, which means they're participating in, you know, extraction methods for these minerals and production that's harming the environment. So I think that's, like, another thing we need to talk about as we talk about the scope that Minnesota is going to play in getting to a carbon-neutral future, and we've had that conversation. So I just wanted to say it for this bill. But one of the concerns I have when I read the language is kind of thinking about the what-if scenarios, and maybe that's what I want you to kind of talk about a little bit. I understand that it'll, you know, for 1,200-watt units, but what's prohibitive of, let's say I'm a renter and I buy five of these things and I plug them all in on the balcony, and now I've got 6,000 watts feeding in to the breaker. You know, that would cause an issue. I think there's also an issue, too, of, you know, would there be anything that you'd have to work, like if you are a renter, do you have to work with your landlord or let them know that you're doing it? Because maybe it's wired differently by not having licensed electricians involved. I just worry that we could be creating larger problems. And again, I say that not to be like opposed against the bill, because I see the point. It's, you know, people having the individual freedoms and rights to generate power if they want to. But I also, like, it's the think twice, act once. And whenever you hear the word simple bill in a committee, that's what always makes me think even more, because there's no such thing as a simple bill. I was told that my freshman year here. So those are just kind of things I wanted to talk about and ask you about.
Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I did not say it was a simple bill. There are no simple bills. I did not. Okay? Agree with you on that. Look, 80% of solar use, 80% come from China. Well, then, you know, it's really unfortunate that we got rid of the Inflation Reduction Act that was trying to create more incentives to do a solar industry here in the United States. So just said to that. Your what-if scenarios. A few thoughts. One is, what if someone buys five hair dryers and plugs them in all at once? There's a certain amount of what-ifs that, you know, people can do stupid things. That said, right, at this time with the UL standard, licensed electricians do need to be involved. It requires a special plug. And special way the circuit is set up. And so that was done to just from a safety perspective. So these are not, you can't just plug them in at this time to any outlet. We may be able to get there. That's what they do in Germany. But because our systems are a little bit different, that's what the UL 3700 is about. And so there are guidelines to, you know, to what kind of circuits can be used and plugs can be used.
And we've got about 3 minutes left and three testifiers. So Representative Sexton. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Igo, go ahead.
Just a brief follow-up. So thank you for that. I appreciate that. Again, I just think thinking long-term to also making sure, like, education is done properly. Mm-hmm. Because I also want this to – I wouldn't want this to take advantage of folks that think it's going to save them a lot of money. Yes, it's cheaper than installed solar, right? That's widely documented. but also like making sure that people understand the return on investment, right? You know, you spend the $2,000-$3,000 on this, it's not like you're not going to have a power bill. And I think that's important too. So again, not opposed, not necessarily for yet, but open to having conversations and hopefully getting somewhere.
Thank you, Representative Igo. Representative Sexton.
I'll be brief. So I appreciate UL 700. That's usually for the object. But if you're an electrician, your Bible is the National Electric Code. And I didn't hear any testifiers who testified that Article 690 has been updated for the National Electric Code, because that would be the Bible that the electricians would follow to actually install this properly. Point number two, insurance companies, how do they feel about it? Because, you know, if you're going to spend $40,000 to put rooftop solar on, you're going to tell your insurance companies. But if you're in an apartment, how's that going to affect the apartment owner's insurance? Because we haven't had any of the testifiers who represent the insurance industry come in and talk about it. So I just leave those two thoughts with you.
Good points. Representative Kraft, do you want to respond, or do you want to hold that response and we can give a...
Go ahead.
Let's go to Representative Swazinski.
Just thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick comment. One, I think you could just go online and actually purchase these. Currently, they're not illegal technically. But just one concern I do have as these things move forward, you know, I'm not sure if the safety mechanisms are, but whenever it's in a communal space, when it's a apartment complex, I think of if you're pushing juice back into the system, you, like from a firefighting standpoint and how that process, I'd like to learn more about that. So.
Well, the bill is being laid over, so there will be opportunities to continue to work on it. And with that, do you want to say a final word?
Real briefly.
You bet.
So thank you for the comments. I can follow up on all of those. I've been very much intimately involved with the Department of Labor on this. We talked about, you know, how this would be done so that it would be safe perspective from using it and from electrical perspective. So Representative Sexton, we should follow up, and I think we can resolve your issues on that. I hope we can move this forward. Thank you.
And with that, the bill's laid over. And with that, we are also adjourned.